Johnston at 10:07.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's not by chance that President George Bush is at the UN today, September 12th. While the nation still reverberates with the flag-snapping patriotism of yesterday's memorials, and while the reminders of American and global vulnerability are still fresh, Bush is to make his most detailed case to date for what he calls regime change in Iraq, challenging the United Nations to either act or step aside to make President Saddam Hussein comply with resolutions calling for the destruction of his chemical and biological weapons, or to accede to the use of American and allied military force. Today, in a two-hour special on The Connection, we will hear the President make his case live from the UN General Assembly. Before and after, we'll talk to international and domestic journalists and policymakers about the President's rationale, about the skepticism and the support for his Iraq policy at home and around the world. Connection listeners, we'll hear the President. We want to know if you think he's made a good case for an attack on Iraq. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. As I mentioned, we have a number of international journalists and scholars standing by. We're going to start with Judy Keene. She is White House correspondent for USA Today. She is at the UN today covering the speech. Hi, Judy. Judy, are you there?
Yes.
You wrote a long piece yesterday in the paper when you take apart for us and explain to us how the policymaking worked. And I seized on one phrase I wanted you to help us with, a sort of Iraq policymaking by osmosis. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's really interesting. One of the amazing things that we discovered in reporting this piece is that there was never really a formal decision-making meeting at the White House or anywhere else where this policy was set. The administration never ordered a national intelligence estimate, which is basically an assessment of the threat capability of enemy nations conducted by U.S. intelligence agencies. Senator Durbin of Illinois called it stunning that that was never sought. It's almost as though the president knew, even before September 11th, that he intended to try to oust Saddam, and there was never a formal decision-making process.
But policy does evolve based on circumstances. When people talk to you about how it is that the president got to where he is today, poised to take his place at the United Nations, is there an explanation of, is there anything, any one thing that anybody points to that says, aha, that was it?
Not surprisingly, it's the events of September 11th. A lot of people may say, hey, wait a minute, Iraq and Saddam had nothing to do with al-Qaeda, at least not that any evidence has been presented so far to date. But administration officials told us, in fact, that on the speech to Congress that the president gave on September 20th of last year, less than 2 weeks after September 11th, he very nearly included in that speech a reference to Saddam, to Iraq's efforts to develop weapons of mass destruction, and his intent to do something about it. This policy has been in place for a long time, even though, as I said, it was never really debated by the top administration officials.
Judy, you know that people within the administration have been talking about an attack on Iraq for months now, with or without multilateral assistance, with or without allies. How key do the White House people see this speech at the UN today?
This is the president's first attempt at making his case to a global audience. Everyone knows that most international leaders, most people across the world, are opposed to this. Only Great Britain stands at Bush's side ready to embark on this course. They have to make the case. It's fascinating because Bush, who's been repeatedly accused of being a unilateralist, is making his case through an international body. It goes against his instincts. On the other hand, it's going to be fascinating because he's going to be accusing the UN of basically passing empty resolutions cracking down in Iraq. The White House released early today a document that's basically an indictment of the UN's lax enforcement of its own resolutions called A Decade of Deception and Defiance. That document ticks off each of the 16 resolutions and provides what it calls ample evidence that the UN has failed to back up any of them.
Judy, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Judy Keene, White House correspondent for USA Today. She's at the UN. Getting ready to cover the president's speech at this very moment in the United Nations General Assembly. The Secretary General Kofi Annan is making a speech which was, the text of which has been released and made public and covers a wide range of topics, including Afghanistan and the Middle East. Just a few moments ago, though, he basically set the table for the tone of the conversation today about the difference between unilateral action and multilateral action. So we'll listen to just a piece of the speech. Here is Secretary General Kofi Annan.
Mr. President, I believe that such a response can only succeed if we make full use of multilateral institutions. I stand before you as a multilateralist, by precedent, by principle, by charter, and by duty. I also believe that every government that is committed to the rule of law at home must be committed also to the rule of law abroad. And all states have a clear interest as well as clear responsibility to uphold international law and maintain international order. Our founding fathers, the statesmen of 1945, had learned that lesson from the bitter experience of two world wars and a Great Depression. They recognize that international security is not a zero-sum game. Peace, security, and freedom are not finite commodities like land, oil, or gold, which one state can acquire at another's expense. On the contrary, the more of peace and security and freedom any one state has, the more its neighbors are likely to have. And they recognize that by agreeing to exercise sovereignty together, they could gain a hold over problems that would defeat any one of them acting separately.
It's a message that Secretary General Kofi Annan has repeated in a number of different forms whenever Iraq has come up, the difference between one nation acting alone and the exercise of the body working together. With me this hour, Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist magazine. He joins us on the phone from Hong Kong. Mustafa Kamal Al-Sayed teaches political science at the University of Cairo. He joins us from a BBC studio in that city. And Constance Stelzenmüller is political editor with Die Zeit, the German Newsweekly. She joins us from her office in Hamburg. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Constance, let me begin with you, if I can. I asked Judy Keene how important Bush's speech is being seen in the United States today. How importantly is it being regarded in Europe?
Well, I think all the Europeans will be having their ears glued to their radios or their eyes glued to the TV screens, and certainly people in government. Having said that, the Chancellor of Germany, my country, has upped the ante considerably by saying that he will under no conditions participate in military action against Iraq. And the General Secretary of his, the reigning Social Democrat Party, which is up for re-election on the 22nd, went one further to say that even if there were proof of Iraqi ambitions to use weapons of mass destruction, Germany should not participate. So, and they're pretty much alone with that.
Bill Emmett, you've been tracking the U.S. basically setting the stage for this. Do you see this as a key moment?
Yes, I do think it's a key moment. I think that what's crucial to understand is that the U.S. needs allies, but that in making a statement like this, essentially to Saddam Hussein through the U.N., it's very important that it doesn't give him the idea that if he can only divide the UN as he's done in the past, then he can stave off defeat. And so I think that we're hearing both a willingness by the US to go through the UN and, I think, quite a wide willingness outside Germany to support that approach, but also an effort by George Bush to say, this is a credible threat to you, Saddam Hussein. You cannot just divide the United Nations and prevent us from doing it. We will also do it outside. So there are two messages here.
There is, though, precious little support if we're to read the papers from the Arab world about the way editors, reporters, writers, and leaders are talking about this plan. Mustafa Kamal al-Sayed, I want to ask you about the meeting of foreign ministers of the Arab League meeting just a few days ago, because they seemed not to even want to hear whether or not there was anything that the president had to say on this.
I think, as you said earlier, the decision to launch a military attack on Iraq has been taken long time ago, before September the 11th. I was in Washington in March 2001, and I heard from some people who are quite well informed a question, what Egypt would do if the U.S. launches military attack on Iraq. I think this is a well-known agenda by some people who surround the president, who are in the Defense Department, who are at the National Security Council. They wanted to launch this attack on Iraq with no evidence whatsoever that Iraq is linked to terrorism or that Iraq constitutes a threat to
U.S. So this is what? Interest. This is just window dressing?
Yeah, I think this is a Public Relations Act. The president is trying to give the impression that he listens to his critics at home and in Europe by going to the United Nations. But I think he has already made the decision.
Let's have a listen to something that the British Prime Minister Tony Blair said a couple of days ago in a speech to the Trade Unions Congress in Blackpool. Many people were looking at Blair's remarks as perhaps an even earlier opening salvo in the marketing, public relations, the paving of the way to Iraq. This is Tony Blair speaking 2 days ago.
Let it be clear, therefore, that he must be disarmed. Let it be clear that there can be no more conditions, no more games, no more prevaricating, no more undermining of the UN's authority. And let it also be clear that should the will of the UN be ignored, action will follow. Diplomacy is vital, but when dealing with dictators, and none in the world is worse than Saddam, diplomacy has to be backed by the certain knowledge in the dictator's mind that behind the diplomacy is the possibility of force being used. Because I say to you in all earnestness, if we do not deal with the threat from this international outlaw and his barbaric regime, it may not erupt and engulf us this month or next, perhaps not even this year or next, but it will at some point. And I, for one, do not want it on my conscience that we knew the threat, that we saw it coming, and that we did nothing.
Tony Blair speaking 2 days ago in Blackpool, England, the beginning of the case being made for some kind of military action against Iraq if the UN does nothing as a result of speeches that are and will be underway in the United Nations in just a few moments. Connection listeners, President George Bush is to speak at the United Nations General Assembly. That's due up in about 10 minutes' time. We have, as you've heard on the program, gathered together journalists, scholars, to help us look at what kind of a moment this is in U.S. foreign policy. We're also interested in hearing from you, because this has been very much a public debate in this country. When George Bush makes his case before the United Nations, is he also making his case to the United or to citizens of the United States? And is he making a case that you hear? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're keeping an eye on the UN General Assembly this hour, waiting to go to a speech by President George Bush there. Kofi Annan has finished his speech. The message was simply to the United States to reconsider the use of multilateral force to Iraq to reconsider its refusal to allow weapons inspectors into that country. With me this hour, Bill Amet, editor of The Economist, Mustafa El Said, teaching political science at the University of Cairo, and Constance Stelzenmüller, political editor with Die Zeit. And the three of you will know that I may have to interrupt if the president comes to the podium, but Bill, let me just start with you. Tony Blair says, if something happens and we did nothing, I don't want that on my conscience. What I hear from England is that line's still not resonating with people, that he's not making the case as successfully as he might like.
Yeah, you're right. Needs to bring forward the evidence about Iraq's programs to develop weapons of mass destruction. I think that people naturally are scared of war. People don't like attacking other countries. Why should they? I think it's quite reasonable for them not to. And the point is, as Mustafa El Said quite rightly said, people don't understand that the connection between this and the terrorist attacks of September the 11th for the reason that there is no such connection. It doesn't follow from September the 11th, and therefore, just as in Britain as in elsewhere, there's a certain disconnect in people's minds. The truth is that Tony Blair is right, in my opinion, that we do need to deal with Saddam Hussein, but it's been the same agenda since 1991 of his failure to abide by UN resolutions, a failure to abide by his own international obligations, and his continued determination to develop weapons of mass destruction, of which there is evidence, ample evidence, before 1998 when the UN weapons inspectors were expelled, and then since then through intelligence sources, some evidence that he's been continuing. So the trouble is that it's not directly linked to September the 11th, and so people can't understand why now. I mean, the real question is why not before, in my view. This has been a process that's been going on for 11 years. And we should have done something before.
Well, let me turn to Mustafa El Said on this, because when you talk about why now and the particular time, and one of the aspects of the debate in the United States is that there is still a significant military exercise underway in Afghanistan. The Middle East conflict seems to be at something of a deadlock right now. And so introducing an American military presence in Iraq does what at this point?
I think there are people around the president in U.S. media who would like to influence public debate in the U.S. The problem for the U.S. in the Middle East is not continued Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Does, everybody in the U.S. know that, for over 70 days, Palestinians are confined to their homes. They live under almost a permanent curfew.
And but connect that to Iraq for me.
Yes. Yeah, I am connecting it to Iraq. So those people in the White House and in the U.S. media would like the U.S. public opinion to forget completely about Israel and to focus on something else. So I think this serves the interests of those people, and also it serves the interests of, oil companies who surround the president. So I think this is an agenda which has nothing to do with terrorism or the threat of weapons of mass destruction. And nobody takes seriously the question that Iraq constitutes a threat to the U.S. Come on. I mean, U.S. has lived with the Soviet Union for 50 years, and the U.S. has nuclear weapons, hydrogenic weapons, has weapons of mass destruction, has missiles, and the U.S. has lived with this. So does Iraq, after 11 years of the end of the Second Gulf War with continued sanctions, constitute a threat to the U.S.? I am a professional political scientist, and I think anyone who tells me that Iraq constitutes a threat to the U.S. Is taking me as a fool.
Constance, let me hear from you.
Well, I tend to side with Bill Emmett on this one. I do think that Iraq presents a threat. The ANSCOM discovered and destroyed enormous quantities of materials for making weapons of mass destruction, and I think we can reasonably assume that similar stuff has been going on since the inspectors left in 98. Having said that, the problem with at the moment is indeed that where there is no clear and present danger made of which we have proof, clearly America has not been able to show that there is a connection between the assumptions about Iraq and the attacks of September 11th. And unfortunately, under international law as it stands, preemptive attack is against the law. It's that simple, and that is why so many people are reluctant. To prove that there is a danger which has to be preempted, you really have to convince people. And clearly, European politicians, except Tony Blair, do not feel convinced yet.
Constanza, thanks for being with us on the program. I know you have to go off.
Hello?
Yes, I was just saying thanks for being with us.
Thank you, that's kind of you.
I gather you have to go off. So to say, that's Constanza Stelzner-Müller, political editor with Die Zeit, the German Newsweekly. Bill Emmett staying with us. Mustafa Kamal El Sayed from the University of Cairo is also staying with us. We're expecting the president any moment now. Bill Emmett, I just want to as a matter of fact, let me do this with Mustafa. The issue of weapons inspection. If Iraq wants to be seen as not a threat, why is it that the Arab League, countries like Egypt, don't put the pressure on Saddam Hussein? Let the weapons inspectors in. Show that you're not lining up Scud missiles to go into Israel and building weapons of mass destruction. Why won't the Arab nations put that pressure on Saddam Hussein?
I think Arab foreign ministers have asked for balanced implementation of UN resolutions, and the Secretary General of the Arab League has said that he is expecting the Iraqi government to accept the return of UN weapons inspectors, and I do hope that the Iraqis will do this. Why they haven't done this so far? I think they would like, a sort of, a package deal, in the sense that they would like a discussion of the return of inspectors, and at the same time also some promise to end the sanctions. I think it is completely unreasonable to maintain the sanctions regime for 11 years and, to find always an excuse to maintain the sanctions. And, I would stand for, ending the sanctions regime and establishment of a very strict inspection system. So I think, the Iraqis, did not say that they are completely opposed to the return of the inspectors, but they would like, an overall discussion of the whole question, not just the return of the inspectors, but also an end to the sanctions regime. And I think this sanctions regime is completely, historically unprecedented.
Let me turn to Bill Emmett on the weapons inspection, on the UN turning the pressure up to allow those inspectors back in. Can you see that as a possible alternative to military intervention?
Yes, I can, because I think that Britain's position, and I agree with it, is that if Saddam Hussein would let the weapons inspectors in unconditionally to go anywhere in Iraq completely freely, in other words, if he agrees to something that he has not agreed to at any moment during the last 11 years, then there should be no military action. And I agree with that, and I think that the United States would find it very difficult to override that, because I think that everyone would be against them, including Britain. Where I differ from Mustafa El Sayed is in thinking that the sanctions are an American problem. The fact is that in 1991, when the ceasefire resolution was passed by the United Nations, provision was made for the sanctions to be lifted after 1 year, 1 year only, if Saddam Hussein had complied with the resolution to allow weapons inspectors in unconditionally. The fact is that he didn't. It's his fault that the sanctions are still there. And that fact, and the fact that the sanctions cannot be lifted as long as he does not comply with the resolutions, means that it's very unlikely that this route will be taken, because I don't believe that he's willing to allow the inspectors in unconditionally.
Though I've worked as a reporter,
needs to explain why they won't allow them in unconditionally.
I've worked a couple of times in Baghdad as a reporter and asked questions of the people there about the weapons inspectors, and the answer always seems to me to have more to do with sovereignty and pride and not wanting to open one's borders to an X-ray of recent and former enemies, rather than saying that Iraq has something to hide. And I'm wondering, Mustafa and Bill, perhaps Mustafa first, whether or not that's not part of what complicates this.
Yeah, I think it's only part of it. The other part is that, you know, some inspection has been done. Some destruction of Iraqi potential to produce weapons of mass destruction has been completed. And I think this has been reported by the UN itself. So it's not true that, you know, we are going to start from scratch now. I think the problem is that the inspection regime is being manipulated in order to continually accuse the Iraqi government of obstructing the work of the United Nations. So I think, you know, we have also to give the Iraqis credit for saying that, you know, a large part of the inspection has been done. The inspection regime was ended in 1998, but I think before that, a large part of its work has been completed.
Bill?
I'm afraid I think that that's completely wrong. What happened was that the weapons inspections did find a number of weapons caches, but many of them were concealed from them deliberately by the Iraqi government. The largest part of biological weapons, the so-called VX nerve agents, were found only after a defection by Saddam Hussein's son-in-law from Iraq, who revealed the existence of stocks of these things in sites that the UN weapons inspectors had been visiting. So the fact is that the Iraqi government's record is not one of just resisting this on pride. I disagree with that. I think that they resisted it in order to conceal their weapon stocks. That's understandable in its way. They want to remain powerful. They want to keep their weapons. But their record in the 1980s and during the Gulf War tells us internationally that they should not be allowed to keep those weapons. They have just continually broken their international obligations, and they need to be dealt with on that basis.
Let's just bring us back to where we are. President George Bush is at any moment now going to take the podium at the General Assembly of the United Nations to make a speech that his people say will lay out the current and specific details of the U.S. position on what Iraq should do concerning reports of chemical, biological weapons of mass destruction. Some reports say that Bush is going to propose a new UN resolution with a very specific and short timeline for weapons inspections to resume, and if that doesn't happen, that will open up the way for some sort of military action. Mustafa El-Sayed, also something that's been going over the past few days is Bush on the telephone to President Putin in Russia, to the foreign policy chief Hario Solana in the European Union, to the French president, and also to Jiang Zemin. These are, it is reported from the White House, an effort to try and build an international coalition. You were saying at the beginning, too much window dressing here. Is that also window dressing?
Yeah, I think, you know, President Bush is not going to change his mind. I think all the people whom he contacted, definitely the president of Russia, the Chinese president, the French president, all of them, you know, advised him not to take military action. I think he has decided to take military action, but I think in response to debates in the Senate, comments in American newspapers, he's trying to show that he is trying to build a coalition, but whether he succeeds in building it or not, I think he will go to military action. I think, you know, the objective of the U.S. is change of regime in Baghdad. It's not, you know, the question of getting rid of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, because even if these weapons were there, I think they are not meant to attack the U.S. I think, you know, as was said before, this probably, you know, I don't know, I do not agree to the presence of these weapons, but for the Iraqi regime, which I do not support, I support the Iraqi people, these are meant to introduce a sort of balance of power vis-a-vis Iran in the area. So I think the goal for the U.S. is not really getting rid of weapons of mass destruction, is change of regime. And this is what the U.S. president has said himself. This is what his national security advisor said. So I think, you know, this question of weapons of mass destruction is being used now just as an excuse. But I think there are, you know, broader goals than this.
I want to pick that up with Bill in a minute. But before I do, Mustafa, I understand that our colleagues at BBC in Cairo, who are also covering this story, need to make use of the studio. So I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mustafa Kamal El-Sayed teaches political science at the University of Cairo. Thanks to our friends at BBC in Egypt for the use of their studio. Bill Emmett, Mustafa is saying this has nothing to do with weapon inspections. This has to do with the idea of a regime change, and weapons inspections is just, you know, noise at the periphery.
Well, you know, I agree with Mustafa that weapons of mass destruction are not the only issue. I think that, yes, they definitely want a regime change. But the question is, why is this the case? And the answer to that is, first of all, the weapons of mass destruction. They want a regime that is not going to try to develop and stock and then use weapons of mass destruction, which the Saddam Hussein regime has done. Secondly, I think you have to look at the system that is currently in place to contain this regime because of its past behavior. American and British aircraft policing no-fly zones in Iraq. You see the sanctions that Mustafa complained about. You've got America and Britain, in a sense, surrounding Iraq.
Bill, I'm going to interrupt you there because President Bush is being introduced as we speak at the United Nations. I know you can stay with us for his speech, so we'll continue this after. This is the President of the United States in New York.
Mr. Secretary General, Mr. President, distinguished delegates, and ladies and gentlemen, we meet 1 year and 1 day after a terrorist attack brought grief to my country and brought grief to many citizens of our world. Yesterday, we remembered the innocent lives taken that terrible morning. Today, we turn to the urgent duty of protecting other lives without illusion and without fear. We've accomplished much in the last year in Afghanistan and beyond. We have much yet to do in Afghanistan and beyond. Many nations represented here have joined in the fight against global terror, and the people of the United States are grateful. The United Nations was born in the hope that survived a world war, the hope of a world moving toward justice, escaping old patterns of conflict and fear. The founding members resolved that the peace of the world must never again be destroyed by the will and wickedness of any man. We created a United Nations Security Council so that, unlike the League of Nations, our deliberations would be more than talk, our resolutions would be more than wishes. After generations of deceitful dictators and broken treaties and squandered lives, we dedicated ourselves to standards of human dignity shared by all, and to a system of security. We continue to encourage all parties to step up to their responsibilities as we seek a just and comprehensive settlement to the conflict. Above all, our principles and our security are challenged today by outlaw groups and regimes that accept no law of morality and have no limit to their violent ambitions. In the attacks on America a year ago, we saw the destructive intentions of our enemies. This threat hides within many nations, including my own. In cells and camps, terrorists are plotting further destruction and building new bases for their war against civilization. And our greatest fear is that terrorists will find a shortcut to their mad ambitions when an outlaw regime supplies them with the technologies to kill on a massive scale. In one place, in one regime, we find all these dangers in their most lethal and aggressive forms. exactly the kind of aggressive threat the United Nations was born to confront. 12 years ago, Iraq invaded Kuwait without provocation. And the regime's forces were poised to continue their march to seize other countries and their resources. Had Saddam Hussein been appeased instead of stopped, he would have endangered the peace and stability of the world. Yet this aggression was stopped by the might of coalition forces and the will of the United Nations to suspend hostilities. To spare himself, Iraq's dictator accepted a series of commitments. The terms were clear to him and to all. And he agreed to prove he is complying with every one of those obligations. He has proven. Instead, only his contempt for the United Nations and for all his pledges. By breaking every pledge, by his deceptions and by his cruelties, Saddam Hussein has made the case against himself. In 1991, Security Council Resolution 688 demanded that the Iraqi regime cease at once the repression of its own people, including the systematic repression of minorities, which the Council said threatened international peace and security in the region. This demand goes ignored. Last year, the UN Commission on Human Rights found that Iraq continues to commit extremely grave violations of human rights and that the regime's repression is all-pervasive. Tens of thousands of political opponents and ordinary citizens have been subjected to arbitrary arrest and imprisonment, summary execution, and torture by beating and burning, electric shock, starvation, mutilation, and rape. Wives are tortured in front of their husbands, children in the presence of their parents. And all of these horrors concealed from the world by the apparatus of a totalitarian state. In 1991, the UN Security Council, through resolutions 686 and 687, demanded that Iraq return all prisoners from Kuwait and other lands. Iraq's regime agreed. It broke this promise. Last year, the Secretary General's high-level coordinator for this issue reported that Kuwaiti, Saudi, Indian, Syrian, Lebanese, Iranian, Egyptian, Bahraini, and Omani nationals remain unaccounted for. More than 600 people. One American pilot is among them. In 1991, the UN Security Council, through Resolution 687, demanded that Iraq renounce all involvement with terrorism and permit no terrorist organizations to operate in Iraq. Iraq's regime agreed. It broke this promise. In violation of Security Council Resolution 1373, Iraq continues to shelter and support terrorist organizations that direct violence against Iran, Israel, and Western governments. Iraqi dissidents abroad are targeted for murder. In 1993, Iraq attempted to assassinate the Emir of Kuwait and a former American president. Iraq's government openly praised the attacks of September the 11th. An al-Qaeda terrorist escaped from Afghanistan and are known to be in Iraq. In 1991, the Iraqi regime agreed to destroy and stop developing all weapons of mass destruction and long-range missiles, and to prove to the world it has done so by complying with rigorous inspections. Iraq has broken every aspect of this fundamental pledge. From 1991 to 1995, the Iraqi regime said it had no biological weapons. After a senior official in its weapons program defected and exposed this lie, the regime admitted to producing tens of thousands of liters of anthrax and other deadly biological agents for use with Scud warheads, aerial bombs, and aircraft spray tanks. UN inspectors believe Iraq has produced 2 to 4 times the amount of biological agents it declared and has failed to account for more than 3 metric tons of material that could be used to produce biological weapons. Right now, Iraq is expanding and improving facilities that were used for the production of biological weapons. United Nations inspections also reveal that Iraq likely maintains stockpiles of VX, mustard, and other chemical agents, and that the regime is rebuilding and expanding facilities capable of producing chemical weapons. And in 1995, after 4 years of deception, Iraq finally admitted it had a crash nuclear weapons program prior to the Gulf War. We know now, were it not for that war, the regime in Iraq would likely have possessed a nuclear weapon no later than 1993. Today, Iraq continues to withhold important information about its nuclear program, weapons design, procurement logs, experiment data, and accounting of nuclear materials and documentation of foreign assistance. Iraq employs capable nuclear scientists and technicians. It retains physical infrastructure needed to build a nuclear weapon. Iraq has made several attempts to buy high-strength aluminum tubes used to enrich uranium for a nuclear weapon. Should Iraq acquire fissile material, it would be able to build a nuclear weapon within a year. And Iraq's state-controlled media has reported numerous meetings between Saddam Hussein and his nuclear scientists, leaving little doubt about his continued appetite for these weapons. Iraq also possesses a force of Scud-type missiles with ranges beyond the 150 kilometers permitted by the UN. Work at testing and production facilities shows that Iraq is building more long-range missiles that can inflict mass death throughout the region. In 1990, after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the world imposed economic sanctions on Iraq. Those sanctions were maintained after the war to compel the regime's compliance with Security Council resolutions. In time, Iraq was allowed to use oil revenues to buy food. Saddam Hussein has subverted this program, working around the sanctions to buy missile technology and military materials. He blames the suffering of Iraq's people on the United Nations, even as he uses his oil wealth to build lavish palaces for himself and to buy arms for his country. By refusing to comply with his own agreements, he bears full guilt for the hunger and misery of innocent Iraqi citizens. In 1991, Iraq promised UN inspectors immediate and unrestricted access to verify Iraq's commitment to rid itself of weapons of mass destruction and long-range missiles. Iraq broke this promise. Spending 7 years deceiving, evading, and harassing UN inspectors before ceasing cooperation entirely. Just months after the 1991 ceasefire, the Security Council twice renewed its demand that the Iraqi regime cooperate fully with inspectors, condemning Iraq's serious violations of its obligations. The Security Council again renewed that demand in 1994, and twice more in 1996, deploring Iraq's clear violations of its obligations. The Security Council renewed its demand three more times in 1997, citing flagrant violations, and three more times in 1998, calling Iraq's behavior totally unacceptable. And in 1999, the demand was renewed yet again. As we meet today, it's been almost 4 years since the last UN inspector set foot in Iraq. 4 years for the Iraqi regime to plan and to build and to test behind the cloak of secrecy. We know that Saddam Hussein pursued weapons of mass murder even when inspectors were in his country. Are we to assume that he stopped when they left? The history, the logic, and the facts lead to one conclusion. Saddam Hussein's regime is a grave and gathering danger. To suggest otherwise is to hope against the evidence. To assume this regime's good faith is to bet the lives of millions and the peace of the world in a reckless gamble. And this is a risk we must not take. Delegates to the General Assembly, we have been more than patient. We've tried sanctions. We've tried the carrot of oil for food and the stick of coalition military strikes. But Saddam Hussein has defied all these efforts and continues to develop weapons of mass destruction. First time we may be completely certain he has a nuclear weapons is when, God forbids, he uses one. We owe it to all our citizens to do everything in our power to prevent that day from coming. The conduct of the Iraqi regime is a threat to the authority of the United Nations and a threat to peace. Iraq has answered a decade of UN demands with a decade of defiance. All the world now faces a test, and the United Nations a difficult and defining moment. Our Security Council resolutions to be honored and enforced or cast aside without consequence. Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant? The United States helped found the United Nations. We want the United Nations to be effective and respectful and successful. We want the resolutions of the world's most important multilateral body to be enforced. And right now, those resolutions are being unilaterally subverted by the Iraqi regime. Our partnership of nations can meet the test before us by making clear what we now expect of the Iraqi regime.